Well, in the first half, I'll tell you my plan to get Sonny a job at McDonald's. We'll do a Baldywood with the new Weird Al movie. And I'll tell you a story about Dr. Demento as well. Edward Conlin is going to join us. He's an author and a former police officer. Got some thoughts about policing. We'll do all that right after this.
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, comedian Don Jameson, and the host of Talk to Me, former NYPD officer Edward Conlin. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, a Baldy review of Weird, the Al Yankovic story, and now, on Election Day, a man with no margin of error, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on. We thank you for tuning in and telling a friend. We love that about you, right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
And Bald Brian?
It's purer than the Virgin Mary's coochie.
One of the, something I wrote down from a week and a half ago that I forgot about was, remember this old James Corden thing was going on with the restaurateur, going out to eat and getting a big kerfuffle.
About the all yolk egg omelet?
Yes, she's allergic to egg whites, I guess.
Is that it? Or are you just ultra keto?
That's what I heard. I don't, I mean.
Then maybe just cook them at home.
The most inert thing on the planet has to be an egg white. It's, it would seem weird that you would be everything with eggs. Then, okay, but everyone's allergic to everything and no one can question it anymore. But the biggest losers I was thinking about, I just had this vague memory of this whole debacle from a couple of weeks ago, was Weight Watchers.
Do tell.
Didn't Weight Watchers sign up James Corden like 2 years ago or something to be the new spokesperson?
Oh, wasn't he like talking? I remember him sitting on a couch like talking to overweight women who had lost the weight through Weight Watchers. Tell me a story.
Yes, he had pledged to lose weight. He something got on the Weight Watchers.
He's on the website.
And blah, blah, blah. He started losing the weight, I think, when the initial check showed up a couple of years ago. But I feel like he's put it back on, and he's doing a lot of non-Weight Watcher meals out at fancy New York bistros.
Right.
So I think for them, they're kind of the losers. I mean, the guy owns the restaurant, James Corden, but the real loser is Weight Watchers here.
Yeah.
Because
let's hold him the bag.
I don't think he's lost an ounce. And I don't know if he's still a spokesperson for them.
Well, here's what it says on their website. It says, WW partner James Corden has lost 28 pounds. That's like saying, like when you're gambling, like how much do you weigh? Well, at one point, I was up 4,500.
Right.
Yeah. And then it says, I've changed my life without disrupting my life.
But for the company who offers you meals, arguing over restaurateurs and tweets is probably not
great
what you
business.
Want. All right. So a little blast from the past.
Also, before we leave James Corden, did you see the controversy with his with the Ricky Gervais thing?
It's enough.
No.
Oh, we have to. Now, you could probably explain this to us best, knowing, you know, a very well-respected and renowned talk show host
was
yourself.
Was about ripping off a bit?
It's word for word. Now, my guess is the writers wrote this for him. Maybe it wasn't his knowledge. Chris, do you know something?
Yeah. Oh, so this was last week. So James Corden's talking about Elon Musk taking over Twitter. And he likened it to Twitter being a town square. And the way he this was being shared all over Twitter. It was akin to a bit that Ricky Gervais did in one of his specials in 2018.
And they mash them up.
Yeah. So you would watch it.
All right.
Because if someone puts up a poster in a town square that says guitar lessons available,
that's like going into a town square, seeing a big notice board, and there's a notice guitar lessons.
Like you don't get people in the town go, I don't want to play the guitar.
And you go, but I don't fucking want guitar lessons.
Well, then that sign wasn't for you. It was for somebody else. You don't have to get mad about all of it.
Fine. It's not for you then. Just walk away. Don't worry about it.
It's pretty word for word and pretty specific.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ricky Gervais tweeted about it saying, oh, this is a, he called attention to it. But he said, look, obviously, James didn't write that. It was a writer who wrote that for him, and he didn't know. Because Ricky's actually, he in one of his old shows, so he talked shit on James Corden. He like made a couple cracks about James Corden not being funny and things like that. So there was like a little bit of like beef between them, but Ricky went out and just said, "Look,
delicious beef."
Yeah, James didn't write it, but no worries, no harm, no foul. It's fine.
It's a good bit.
Yeah, but a lot of people are suspecting, like, with all this bad PR that James has been getting, are his writers jumping into the kind of way that that sabotage. Ellen's employees did?
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, sabotage them.
Well, I always told you I do not know James Corden. I don't think I've ever been on a show. I don't know him at all. But whispers around town will let you know about who's trouble and who isn't a pain in the ass. And James Corden, I would hear those whispers about.
Mm.
Difficult.
Wow.
And you can say what you want, but the whispers in this town, whether it's egomaniac, troublemaker, difficult, the whispers in the town are pretty high batting average. It's like pretty much like the gay whisper.
Oh boy.
Enough whispers about someone being gay for long enough
in this town.
Ironically, so many of us were shocked to find out James Corden isn't gay.
No, that is ironic. I told you I could tell when you walk onto the premises of a late night show or a talk show or any show, it's always the posture of the people who staff the show take on the posture of the people who run the show. And when I did Ellen, I noticed that everyone was needlessly frightened, just scared. I remember so clearly, just like sitting in the green room, you know, you do the whole pre-interview and you're going to talk about Christmas and the kids and vacation or whatever. And the guy just came in and he was like, "You're not going to talk about beef, are you?"
Not Sam Elliott.
Yeah. I said, "No." And he said, "Yeah, please just no talk about barbecuing or beef or hamburger." And I was like, "Yeah, well, it wasn't what we're planning on talking about." He said, "Yeah, just don't. Don't do it." And
but now that you got me thinking about it.
He was scared.
Feels like something that specific is reactionary to something she blew up about the day before or that morning or whatever.
Pork. Yeah, somebody was telling some story and ended up getting into a barbecue for the 4th of July. And then she yelled at the segment producer. Right. The segment producer cannot control the celebrity up there talking about beef, but someone got yelled at.
It would be so great if you just fucked with them and during the interview you were like, "Look, I love you. I got no beef with you. In fact, I'm happy to meet you," and just go for it.
I probably said about the third time they brought it up, which was, now you got it in my head.
Yeah, exactly. Now I can't stop thinking about it.
Stop bringing it up. But there was that. I noticed Letterman had a scared staff, too.
Rosie?
I never did Rosie, but I know a guy who was very high up that that ladder, and he said, "We fire somebody every single day here. Like this is a shit show. Everyone is scared shitless."
Wasn't he made to be the hatchet man?
Yes.
You're basically, he was tasked.
He's the one who had to fire everyone, and then eventually had to fire himself. But and then there'd be Kimmel or Leno.
Yeah.
And there was no vibe.
You don't hear anything.
No.
I don't hear anything.
You wouldn't feel it when you showed up.
Right.
There wasn't anything other than, you know, there's a drink cart in the hall if you want to lube yourself up a little bit and
have
fun out
there.
He's too warm. Yeah, there just wasn't anything. You can go to plenty of places where there's nothing, but you'll feel it when you walk in. All right, so now I was thinking about Weird Al Yankovic, and Brian's got the review.
Did you watch it?
I have not seen it
yet. I watched it last night.
But I was talking, you know, in the trailer, at least they show how Weird Al got his name from Dr. Demento. But do people know where Dr. Demento got his name? So I listened to Dr. Demento when he hit the air, or as far as I know. I mean, that was appointment listening in the 70s for me. God, he was probably on KMET back in the day. I loved the radio, and I loved comedy. So I was going to listen to Dr. Demento on a Sunday night. I think he used to come on Sunday nights. I would, you know, record it with the tape, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of his early Dr. Demento hits was a song by a guy named Nervous Norvis called Transfusion. And it's
You may have brought this up years ago.
It's an interesting song in that it's. We'll play it. From 1956.
Tooling down the highway doing 79. I'm a twin pipe popper and I'm feeling fine. Hey man, dig that. Was that a red stop sign? Transfusion, transfusion. I'm just a solid mess of contusions. Never, never, never gonna speed again. Slip the blood to me, bud. I jump in my rod about a quarter to nine. I gotta make a date with that chick of mine.
Cross the center line, man, you gotta make time. It's about a guy
who
crashes his car every time he goes out, and then he gets a transfusion of blood.
Shoot the juice to me, Bruce. My foot's on the throttle and it's made of lead, but I'm a fast riding daddy with a real cool head. I'm a going to pass a truck on the hill ahead.
So anyway, this was a very controversial song.
Sure.
And they didn't want him to play it on the radio, but Dr. Demento, who wasn't going by Dr. Demento back then, wanted to play it on the radio, and thus they gave him the handle Dr. Demento. Uh-huh.
Like demented for
yes.
playing it.
Yes.
Huh.
I didn't know that.
But make it into the movie.
I remember, you know, hearing My Bologna for the first time on Dr. Demento when he was recording yep. it in the bathroom.
Plays a large part.
It sure does.
The whole, I was there. I wasn't there. I listened every single Sunday. Recorded in a bathroom. Dr. Demento would say this is recorded in a bathroom.
Yeah. Also comes up in another.
Ooh, a little hungry one, open up a package of My Bologna. Ooh, I think the toast is done, the toast is done. Topping with a little of My Bologna. Never gonna stop, eat it up. Such a tasty snack, I always eat too much. And throw up, but also me that is my, yeah, yeah.
All right.
Does anyone call it Bologna?
No. Okay. No, it's an old school thing, though. I think it was Bologna when maybe the transition with Bologna is when it was in the deli case
right.
and it was in a big log, you might order a pound of Bologna, but at some point Oscar Mayer put it in a package and it became Bologna.
Right. The only person I ever heard call it Bologna was Vin Scully, so that would make sense.
It's a little Italian thing.
Yeah.
The also, I was watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yesterday.
Nice.
And I love all the Tarantino films. And on a musical note, there's this crazy guy. Well, anyway, I don't know if this is a timeline screw up or not, but I was noticing that part where Sharon Tate wanted to go watch her movie in the movie theater, and they were running a trailer. And the trailer was for CC and Company,
right?
Which was a movie with Joe Namath.
Okay.
Joe Namath was kind of at the height of his macho powers, and he starred in this horrible biker movie. But that was the trailer that was playing. But I was looking at it, and I was trying to figure out the timeline. The Tate murders took place on August 8th, 1969, but CC and Company didn't come out for over a year later, 1970.
This is something you thought about while you're watching the movie?
I was watching it, and I was like, I remember that CC and Company movie, and I remember certain bits about it. And then I also remember this crazy guy named Wayne Cochran, who was in the movie. Are you looking
That's
at
not
Wayne
a real person.
Wayne Cochran was a
That's a mannequin.
Blue-eyed soul guy. And then he had a song in the movie, which was I Can't Turn You Loose. And then that got into another movie. And you're going to – well, we'll play a little of that for you, and you'll hear the song.
This is very John Waters, the picture we're looking
Can't
at.
Go wrong with the horns.
If John Waters and Donald Trump had a love song.
If I do, I'm gonna lose my mind, yeah. I can't turn you loose.
You can never go wrong with this bass line and the horn.
This is a very Mitch Ryder, the Detroit Wheels kind of feel.
And then the horns kick in, and it's like, oh, you can't go wrong with it.
The baseline's very Sugar Pie Honey Bun.
Mm-hmm. Here it comes.
I love this song. I'm digging this. I like this line.
Oh, you know, we need the horn version of this song, which was featured in the movie, because when you hear the horns, oh, well, here it is. And is this guy dead? And if he is dead, he had to have died in Florida. That's all I know. There's the number one contender for
he died at the age of 78 in 2017. In Miramar, Florida.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dang. That hair. That.
Holy shit.
It's got a Blues Brothers feel to it, too.
Yeah.
So you got the part, the song from the movie. I guess if you show the clip on the trailer from the movie, we'll find that. But
those are the only two. Easily,
you need to find the trailer from CC and Company, and then you can see him in his majesty performing. But the Blues Brothers went on. If you when you hear it with the horns and you see his live version,
oh, they do a version.
You'll go, yeah, this was all over the Blues Brothers movie.
It's originally an Otis Redding song,
that's why
it's just been covered by a bunch of blues bands.
We'll see if we can find that.
We're scrubbing through it. Just give us a second here.
Yeah. It's this guy was a real character.
Yeah, how have we never heard of him?
He was like part pro wrestler, part blue-eyed soul guy, part front man.
Cartoon character.
He was kind of the cookie jar and the crumbles or what?
Cookie jar and the crumbs.
Crumbs.
And the crumbs, yeah.
He's got moves like James Brown.
He can move, too. Yeah. I mean... We'll show you this guy. We'll play it to you from the trailer.
This is the American Revolution.
Karate Kid.
This is such a 69, 70s movie.
So it fucking cooks.
It does.
Oh, it's Peter Blue Brothers.
Yeah, there's an extended, you can find it, we'll get into other things, but there's an 8-minute version of this trailer, I think, that I looked at last
night. Oh, God.
Chris. No, you can scrub it to him, because this song cooks. The other thing that's crazy is I was trying to do the math. I don't know what year this guy was born, but in this movie, he's like 26 years old, and he looks like he's 49.
A hard 49.
Like a hard drinking, yes. Hard loving, hard smoking.
Weathered.
That does not look like a man in his 20s.
His prime.
But I may have screwed up the math on
What's
that.
What's his name?
His name is Wayne Cochran. And there's a extended dance version on the 8-minute trailer that Chris and Dawson look up.
I did find the 3-minute performance, like isolated.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see what that looks like.
He was born in 39.
It cooks. Oh, no, so he was 40. Sorry, he was 39 when he filmed it then. Was he? Yeah, because they filmed it in 69. He was born in 39, then he must be 30.
Cochran, best known for writing Last Kiss. A Pearl Jam covered.
Oh, wow.
Where Can My Baby Be?
Wow.
Every song needs these horns. Guy should have been bigger.
I was just thinking that if he had not had the sort of clownish appearance on stage, would we have taken him more seriously?
I don't know. We took James Brown seriously.
He can perform.
He can move too.
He got stage presence.
He's definitely trying to be white James Brown, yes?
It's working.
I guess.
Yeah.
Here come those horns. All right.
Nice.
Yeah, the late, great Wayne Cochran.
Wow. Oh, he will be missed.
He'll be missed, yeah.
Didn't know the origin of that song.
I don't know if we're, I should have told these guys, if we could stay on music for another mm-hmm. second. On the very top of my Facebook page, Facebook.com/GinaGrad, I don't know if you guys have seen this. It's being passed around on Facebook right now. Rick Rubin, and I don't think it's a joke. I don't know why. Part of me was like, is this real? Rick Rubin playing All-Star for Paul McCartney as it's being produced, and them losing their fucking minds over it. Did Rick Rubin produce that song, Smash Mouth song?
I don't believe.
I don't know.
This is a total hoax, and I don't know that. I don't know why it would be.
Well, they did a documentary together.
Okay, well, maybe this is from
McCartney
that.
McCartney 3-2-1, where the entire documentary was Rick Rubin playing music.
Okay, so then it's real. So
it's
then,
black and white?
Yes.
Then it's
so from
that.
You have to see a little bit of this. It's fucking crazy. Of all the songs
no,
in the world.
No.
What?
This is fake. He was probably playing a Beatles song and blowing his mind, and they replaced it with All Star for a joke.
Oh,
that's
got
to be. It had nothing to do with All Star.
I was like, I have a new respect for All Star. It's edited really well. We should watch it anyway.
He's playing the isolated bass line probably from While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and they replaced it humorously.
Now we have to watch 30 seconds of it because it's really fucking well edited then.
I blame Elon Musk for this shit. This is mis- and disinformation.
My friend posted it, and this is what I said. I'll paraphrase. I'm confused. This feels too good to be true. Is it real? He goes, I think so, and I'm delighted.
No. Let's see.
This was 4.5 hours.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Well, you go.
Here's a little number.
Just watch.
Paul's digging it.
They pot it up and down.
That's how the documentary is. Here it is without bass. Here it is.
Right. And they'll keep doing it.
Dawson's so mad.
I'm not mad, but you can tell right at the top that it's not.
Oh, I'm so bummed.
That's because you don't want to believe, Dawson.
I really was like, I guess I have a newfound respect for this song.
It is well choreographed.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do some Baldywood and get to yes. Weird Al.
Hooray for Baldywood. He will tell you if a movie's good. Brian will review the flicks that he's seen up on the big screen or in his Netflix queue. Before you spend bucks, remember his taste sucks. He loved that train wreck piece of shit, Transformers 2. Hooray for Baldywood!
Weird! The Al Yankovic Story is a 2022 film directed by a man named Eric Apple. This is his feature debut, first ever feature film. And you can stream it right now on the Roku channel for free. They are giving it to everyone for free. You got to put up with commercials. They have like commercials every 20 minutes, which is mildly annoying, but it's not the kind of movie that's going to take you away out of it. Starring Daniel Radcliffe as Weird Al Yankovic, Evan Rachel Wood, Rainn Wilson, Toby Huss, the great Toby Huss, Julian Nicholson, and Al Yankovic himself as not himself. There are innumerable cameos mm-hmm. in this movie. I don't want to spoil any of them. They're a fun discovery. 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, 88% amongst the people. People are unified in their love for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Gina saw this mm-hmm. as well last night, so don't chime in. I'll talk about it off the air. No, by all means, let me know where I'm stepping astray. But so the movie, it started as a Funny or Die sketch. It was a sketch, and the movie follows that sketch pretty faithfully. It was done by the same director. It sort of starts off as a very familiar, if you've seen Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox
right.
story, it starts off as a very familiar parody of these horror rock biopics and then goes off in any number of absurd directions. And I'm going to warn people right now, This is a very fun movie. It's a very enjoyable movie. You may want to dial it down in your own brain for a little bit, because do not attempt to follow this like you're following Weird Al's life. This is an absurd take. It's almost like a Zucker comedy from back in the day. Not the sight gags, but the you can't take any of this seriously. Don't attempt to follow the story as though it's linearly describing Weird Al's life. That's not what you're looking
for.
The
director wrote for Crank Anchors in 07. So somebody found online.
Nice. Mm-hmm. We have a clip. This is from early in the movie. This is a young, this is a 1 minute clip. This is young Al Yankovic as a boy sitting at the dinner table with his mom and dad. Dad works at the factory. No idea what the factory makes. He just works at the factory. He lost a hand, and he's always trying to get Al to give up his dreams and come work at the factory with your old man. And Al, young Alfred, explains, no, I want to make songs for a living. I want to change the words and make new songs out of old. And this is how that goes over with his blue-collar parents.
Did you hear that, Mary? Well, we got a regular Bing Crosby on our hands, don't we?
Nick, you're embarrassing him.
Oh, am I? Why don't you sing us a little ditty, Bing, huh? Such a little songbird. Sing one for us.
Amazing grapes, how sweet the juice. It tastes so good to me.
Stop! What in God's name are you doing? Those aren't the right words.
I know. I made them better.
By changing the lyrics to a well-known song? No, boy, what you're doing is confusing and evil. My God, and I will not have that kind of blasphemy in my own home.
But, Dad...
What has gotten into you, Alfred? With the songs and the crazy magazines? That is all going to stop now, young man.
Honey, I know it's hard to hear this, but your dad and I had a long talk, and we agreed it would be best for all of us if you just stop being who you are and doing the things you love.
So that's how it starts off.
That's the normalest part of the whole movie.
The horrified mother finds like a loud Hawaiian shirt hidden under his bed like it was porn. Mm-hmm. And she's like horrified. And then it goes there's like a scene where Dr. Demento takes him under his wing and brings him to a pool party like you see in Boogie Nights. Mm-hmm. But it's populated entirely with 80s like Pee Wee Herman's there.
Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol's there. Gallagher's there. Everyone,
Grace Jones.
Yeah, everyone big from the 80s is there.
And Grace all, Slick?
Grace,
no.
Grace Jones. Well, okay. There's
Grace
two Graces. Yeah, sorry. That's right.
And that's absurd.
Don't forget about the party he's not allowed to go to.
There's a polka party where he becomes an instant celebrity.
Yeah, like that's the rock music of the universe.
Everything is folded in on itself and like can't be taken seriously. But the idea that Weird Al Yankovic is a big enough celebrity in our time to make a movie about his life is in and of itself weird. You know what I mean? Or bizarre or absurd. So here we are. At one point he goes to Colombia to rescue his girlfriend Madonna from Pablo Escobar. She's been kidnapped because he won't play his birthday party. It's that kind of movie. It's just absurd.
It goes from like, is this real? To, okay, this is a fever dream.
But it's good,
right? It's good.
It's very fun.
Not only is it very good and very funny, it's fun. Remember fun movies?
Yes.
Like enjoyable, fun movies. This is a movie you, if you're listening, you and the spouse or the boyfriend or the girlfriend or whoever, even the teenagers, this is not a lewd. It's probably PG-13.
Yeah, I'm guessing. Daniel Radcliffe acts his balls off.
He's great.
It's great.
Well, now I want to see it.
Everyone's in on the joke.
Yeah.
It's a fun movie. It's an enjoyable time. I recommend if you got some downtime this weekend or any time the upcoming couple of weeks, it's free on the Roku channel. You'd be a mistake to miss this one.
Hooray for Bollywood!
Where do you guys come down on this notion? Changing gears. Hypothetically, but curious. I have talked to many successful people. I've interviewed many successful entrepreneurs and business people and people with startup companies and movers and shakers. Many, many of them said, my first job was at McDonald's. And then they said, I learned to work by working at McDonald's.
Makes sense.
My first job was at McDonald's, and people kind of go, well, you don't want to do X, Y, or Z. It's really just about you standing over a grill, you doing a sweep and a mop of the dining area and the outdoor area. It's just you working.
Sure.
It's just a bunch of shit you don't want to do. And you talk to everyone now, and everything has to have some sort of direct correlation. Like, well, if you're going to get your young boy into something and he wants to do this, then what the hell does burgers have to do with that? And so what it has to do with is fucking work.
Right.
Getting up, showing up, and doing shit you don't want to do for extended periods of time. So Sonny's at the age where it's time to start looking for a job. And I told him, why don't you go to the McDonald's? There's a McDonald's down the street. Just go there and get a job. And he was like, because it's a shit job.
No.
And by the way, it pays like $17.50 an hour now or something.
I'll take
like
it.
You can
get, I wouldn't have given.
You can get some cash because there's not enough people who want to do it. Anyway, I said, go get a job at the McDonald's. And he was like, I'd rather
do anything else.
And I said, yeah, but you know, you go there, you learn to work. You know, remember that? Remember when you had to work, get up, get dressed, go down, show up, punch in. It's very, you get a time clock and a card and everything.
Well, if I can wax for a second, it's not that different than like 2-a-days in football. I mean, obviously the physical part is different, but really what you're learning is accountability to the group. You do your job so this thing can succeed. And McDonald's, it sucks because some guy's making all the money as a franchise owner, but whether it's football or McDonald's, you're doing your little shit job so that the whole thing can work.
I would argue that And then within McDonald's, there's work in the register, which seemed cushy to the guy.
Yeah, there's a hierarchy.
It's like wide receiver versus, you know, offensive guard.
I was working that grill. Stood over that hot slab of steel all day and made burgers. And then the second thing slowed down, it was sweeping them up. So I had this thing pop into my head. But here's where the hypothetical comes in.
Okay.
I'm telling Sonny, go down to McDonald's. You know, they'll pay you $16-17 an hour and learn how to work. He's saying, I don't want my cuticles to smell like onions when my shift ends. Chris has a list of celebrities who worked at McDonald's.
Oh, wow.
This popped into
my
head.
Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson.
What if I subsidized his working at McDonald's? What if I said, they'll pay you $16 an hour, and I'll tack on another $5 or $10 or whatever an hour. It makes no never mind to me financially. He would get the benefit from working, but it's still a kind of bullshit environment because who has a job where their parent tacks a few bucks on an hour?
Nobody.
But then on the other hand, if he got from $16 an hour to $23 an hour.
Yeah.
That might be enough incentive. Good parent, bad parent, what do we think?
Realistic parent. I mean, it strikes me as like, is this where we're at? But yeah, this is where we're at. We have to, you know, incentivize people to work.
I think Brian's right. I think it's a realistic parent. If we're just putting this in as an idea, we're like, Feb, what's wrong with you? Like, just let him go get a job. He should be so lucky. But you're right. In the environment we're all in this country, in this time, in the environment these children are in a very in a loving, successful home in a nice neighborhood, the $5 might make the difference, and it could do him a lot of good in life.
List of celebs. Now I'm going to have to present this to Sonny, so let's hope there's some NBA ballers on that list.
Well, let's kick this one off with Jay Leno.
Oh,
done.
Yeah, got to start working at McDonald's. Annie McDowell, Macy Gray, James Franco, Rachel McAdams, Pharrell, Jeff Bezos. Sharon Stone, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
A lot of the NBA players played in the McDonald's All-Star game.
I'll bring that up.
Yeah, that might work.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Hey, Sman, you were talking about Biden talking about these hidden fees from companies on different things. You know, I think it's pretty rich for him or anyone in the government to give us a lecture on this topic when that's about all the government does is put surcharges and fees on things. You know, sometimes there's even taxes assessed on things like cell phones and whatnot that you don't even realize. It's absolutely ridiculous. Taxation is theft. Get it on.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Completely agree. Edward Conlin is joining us. Got a podcast out called Talk to Me. It's available wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'll talk some law enforcement with a guy who's walked the beat. Good to see you, Edward.
Good to be here.
A lot of talk in the news about crime and New York and subways and all this stuff. But you started off in the Bronx, right? South Bronx?
Yeah, I started there in 95, walking the beat in the housing projects in the South Bronx. So it was right at the beginning when the city started turning around.
It seems pretty evident to me that you just put more cops on the street and we'll have less street crime, but there always seems to be a perpetual argument about that. But from your perspective, what do you think?
More cops is always a good thing. We're down a couple of thousand from our height. But the big problem for us is you know, we've made more gun arrests than we have in history, but when 80% of the people we lock up for having a gun are out shortly after, you know, the impact is limited. There's a whole series of criminal justice reforms that were passed over the last couple of years that really make every part of the criminal justice system less functional.
It seems to me that almost all the crime is committed by a very small percentage of individuals who engage in it over and over again.
And it is. It's a small number of people, and it's even a pretty small area. Just a couple of percent of the streets account for, you know, maybe 20% of the crime, maybe 5% of the area in the city is almost 50% of the crime. That's a general rule. So it's, you know, it's not, you don't have to lock up everybody. You just have to lock up enough of the right people and make that arrest matter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it gets controversial because it always takes a turn for the racial, and maybe that's why politicians are always trying to stay away from it. But we have, you know, New York City was a scary place in the 70s, and they talked about people getting mugged in Central Park and all that kind of stuff. And then Giuliani just said, well, we're going to flood the street with cops and we're going to do stop and frisk. And it just went away dramatically, went down dramatically. And then at some point we decided that we didn't like that anymore. And then it just went the other direction. There's also the Ferguson effect, which is pulling back the cops just kind of means more criminals. And now you have a recruitment issue, I'm guessing. I mean, who would want to be a cop these days?
Yeah, nationally, cops all over the country, they're quitting faster than they ever used to, and it's harder to replace them. I mean, the turnaround in New York City, though, was just so incredible. We went from 2,000 murders a year, 5,000 shootings, 100,000 robberies. By 2019, when everybody decided, you know, this, our criminal justice system is in such a crisis, we have to turn everything upside down, we had just over 300 shootings, about 1,000, 300 murders, about 1,000 shootings, maybe 13,000 robberies. So, I mean, the change, you can't overestimate it. Dramatic. And we got a lot less people in prison too. We went, you know, Rikers went from like 20 something thousand people in Rikers Island to about 7. So everything was working in the right, going in the right direction. We had less crime, we had less people in prison. And then you know, the legislature in its wisdom decided that you know, we have to make it a lot harder to be a cop and a lot easier to be a criminal. Things went bad much faster, I think, than even cynics would have guessed. We went up 20% in the first 2 months of 2020. So that's even before the pandemic.
Yeah, I don't get why people can't do the math on what the policies will do. Like, obviously, if you pull back the cops, then there'll just be more criminality. And if you loosen up the border, there'll be more people coming to the border. It's pretty straightforward stuff. It's bizarre that we argue about it over and over again. But I think we're living in a time, and I don't know if this is the computer or what it is, but it used to take years for these to feel the effects of policies. Now it's almost immediate. It's like we are going to slow down drilling for domestic oil. 10 minutes later, gas is $7 a gallon in Santa Monica. I mean, in Los Angeles. That stuff used to take a while. It's all like immediate now. You can see it. It's just interesting that politicians don't know what's going to happen when the policies are enacted, but maybe they do and they don't care. I don't know.
They keep on saying in New York, they keep on saying, we need more data. We need more data. We need more data. And, you know, these are every data point is a crime victim. I mean, we're, you know, 400, an extra 100 plus murders, an extra 700 shooting victims, 1,000 more robbery victims. It happened really, really quickly. And they keep on saying we need more data, but it did happen fast and everybody can see it.
Well, also, you don't need data to know that when you walk into the drugstore, the Rite Aid, that all the cartridges for the razors are locked up in a case and everything's got some sort of weird Lucite container around
clamshell.
It that some guy with a magnet strip is going to release. I mean, you just sort of look around. For me, it's always barbed wire around the freeway signs in Los Angeles. Like, I don't need to crunch any numbers. What the fuck's that barbed wire doing up there? And why is it necessary? And then why is everything in the Rite Aid locked away? Well, it lets you know that something is going on.
Well, and besides, we know why it's locked away, because there's a video coming out every day of somebody just sort of laissez-faire walking into a Walgreens and supermarket, sweeping it into a bag and walking out.
Yes.
It's crazy.
And that was Bill Bratton's big insight when he first took over the transit police in the early 90s. You know, the subways were dirty. They were dangerous. You know, but chances are most people are going to be riding the train twice a day, 5 days a week. You know, they're not getting robbed every day. They're not going to get killed at all, even though, you know, the risk was higher back then. But they were going to have a terrible time. There were going to be, you know, a sleeping junkie. There's going to be a drunk yelling at them. They're going to be threatening kids. They're going to have a really bad time. And even though they're not going to get their wallet stolen that day, they're going to walk out mad and they're going to walk out, you know, frustrated about the state of the city. And that was the big thing you have to address, even more than the violent crime, which is obviously important. But everybody's having the same bad time. Not everybody's getting robbed.
You retired from the NYPD when?
I was a cop and then I was a detective and I retired in 2011. And then they brought me back on as a civilian, you know, kind of communications guy in 2018. You know, and I was writing magazine stories basically for the website, which not a lot of people were reading because they were going to the police website for traffic information and street closings. And I was writing magazine pieces. And then we decided to start doing a podcast. And this Talk to Me, which is about how we started the world's first hostage negotiation team in the 70s, has just been a really fun story to tell.
There's a lot of hostage stuff going on in the 70s. It got really popular. A lot of guys hijacking airplanes and taking it to Cuba and Libya and stuff.
That was like the final punchline of the out-of-towners in 1968 movie, whatever it was. They're like finally getting out of New York, heading back to Ohio, and you hear as the plane's in the air, oh, this is your hijacker. We'll be taking you to whatever, Libya or whatever it was. And that was like the joke.
Is what do we need to know about negotiating with folks?
Well, when they started it, it kind of went against every police instinct, because what you do is mostly nothing. I mean, you have to contain the situation and you have to wait, but you don't have to rush in. You don't have to take control, you know, and this is just against every police instinct. You don't let us. I mean, I walked a beat, you know, by myself in the South Bronx, and somebody challenges you or steps to you. You don't let that go. They say you're setting up the next cop. But when you have people holding hostages, people who've already committed really serious crimes and you don't want them to make them worse, you do not have to take action right away. As long as that person is confined, you slow things down. You try and talk to them. You see what they need to hear. And this team was put together after the Munich Olympics, when they were thinking really, really big, you know, international terrorism, hundreds of millions of people watching. And Munich was a disaster. All 11 Israelis were killed. But there was a breakdown on the negotiation side because the Israelis weren't talking to the Palestinians. the West Germans were trying to negotiate, but they had nothing to bargain with, and they just didn't have a SWAT team. So when they did take the airport, it was a mess. They had five cops without radios, without night vision, without scopes, and it was just a mess. So we set up something with kind of with Munich in mind, even though it wouldn't have worked, even though we know a lot more about it, we weren't going to be able to talk those guys out of letting those hostage takers go. But the program was phenomenally successful in every other kind of hostage situation. You know, you have your classic dog day afternoon bank robbery, and that actually happened right before Munich, 2 weeks before Munich. You had a lot of domestic stuff. You had emotionally disturbed people. And, you know, so it was tough that they actually got the program on the ground. They got really lucky. And it worked so much better than they could have expected. I mean, the star of my show is a guy named Frank Bowles, who was the first commanding officer of the team. And he's 92 years old, and he's a great storyteller. He was just the right fit for the team, because he can listen, he can talk, he can, you know, admit he makes a mistake. And he, you know, he ran the team for the first 9 years. He had almost 300 jobs, and over, I think, about 800 hostages were rescued. So it went from a kind of controversial idea to, you know, Frank got a lot of attention. You know, he was on 60 Minutes. He was profiled in New York Times Magazine, and the rest of the and police departments all over the world started doing it the way we did.
I never realized it came out of the Munich Olympics. That makes sense. How much of that, if any, was, hey, we've got an Olympics coming up in New York, not obviously in New York City, but like in the state of New York, we better get on top of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there were a lot of bombs going off in the early 70s. So the FBI counted five a day for one 18-month period in the early 70s. So they're expecting, you know, but you can't talk a bomb out of exploding. You can, you know, this is a specific tool that you're hoping to be able to defuse another kind of situation. And, you know, the thing we prepared for, Munich, just wasn't the thing that happened. But they had plenty of other big, complicated jobs. And I tell the story of a bunch of them. I mean, right after they had this. So Munich was September 72. They set up a little training program that winter. And then in January, four guys took over. Tried to rob a gun store in Brooklyn, a sporting goods store, but they sold a lot of guns right away. Cops surrounded it. The four perps shot two cops, killed a third one. And, you know, they tried this new approach. And there was a siege that went on for 48 hours, and the cops didn't fire a single shot after that first gun battle. So it was kind of proof of concept.
I'm wondering, because this seems so psychologically based and rooted, how much, I don't know at the beginning, how much were they taking requests, suggestions from the psychological community, the behaviorists?
Well, that's one of the great parts of this story. The guy who came up with the approach, you know, let's wait, let's watch, let's mm-hmm. listen, is a guy named Harvey Schlossberg, and he was a patrolman. But he also got a PhD in clinical psychology in his own time, in his own dime. So a new police commissioner comes in, you know, 1971, and he's looking through the files, and this is a patrolman, Schlossberg, PhD, you know, it's got to be a misprint. But it was. So they said, Harvey, you got the job.
Wow.
When they're setting up the program. And he, you know, he was a Freudian, so he knew the way he did things wasn't going to work. You're not going to talk to the guy for 6 months about his mother. And so he had to come up with something new. And he said there was nothing in the library. There was no research. So our cop, who was a psychologist, who had spent most of his career in accident investigations, he's the guy who came up with this thing.
Wow.
Speaking of the Jews and the 72 Munich Olympics and all them dying just coincidentally, I was watching a documentary. I think it was on Adolf Eichmann the other day. And the Mossad, was it that the Jewish Special Forces people? It's called the Mossad.
Yeah.
They went to South America. They went to Brazil, and they're like, they went and got Adolf Eichmann in like 1960. Mm. He fled Germany. He went there, And the Jews, they don't fuck around. They're like,
oh, no.
We're not going to go negotiate. Uh-huh. We're just going to send a few of our guys over. They went and found him. They got him. And they took him back to Israel. And nobody knew what was going on.
Oh.
Yeah.
Didn't they check with extradition policy?
They did this interesting thing. They had to get him through airport security. Mm-hmm. They literally drugged him, put him in one of like their uniforms, and said, he's one of our guys not feeling well. And they're like, well, yeah, go right this way.
This is Weekend at Bernie adjacent.
Yes.
Why is your guy in handcuffs?
Yeah.
He's really not feeling
he's
well.
He's wasted.
Yeah, they don't mess around, those people.
No question.
That's all I got on it.
I have a question. So this is a bit off topic, but my wife and I are taking our six-year-old daughter to New York for the first time in about a month and a half. What should we watch out for? I mean, is it safe to ride the subway everywhere or neighborhoods we should avoid?
Yeah, it's safe. You know, it just feels different. You know, New York till a couple of years ago, it was just people complained about how boring it was and how expensive it was. You know, it smells different. You smell weed all over the place. You know, you'll see more homeless people, but you're going to be fine. You'll have a great trip. See whatever you want to see.
You know, it's interesting to me that you're kind of talking about the subway, and we experience the same thing in L.A. Not with the subway, but you go. Well, it's safe. You're not going to get killed in the subway statistically, but there is the factor of a lot of dicey people roaming around. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have in LA, which is you're probably not going to be the victim of street crime. But back in the day, there were like citizens and then dicey people, and the dicey people were the criminals, and you had to stay away from the dicey people. Now we have citizens, criminals, and then a ton of homeless people who fall under the dicey category heading. And now I'm walking down the street and I'm like, I don't think that guy's a violent criminal. On the other hand, he looks kind of dicey. Mm-hmm. And that, I feel like that's the gestalt. Like, that's why I wouldn't ride the subway in LA. Not because I felt statistically like I was in danger,
you
but just
know
like,
where to find it?
Why don't I want to sit next to a guy just shit himself who might stab me, but I don't think he will, but it's
why have that in your head?
Yes, why have that in our head?
Well, after living in New York for a few years, many years ago, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I would much rather ride the New York subway system than the LA subway system.
Sure.
Without question. You'll be fine.
Good to know.
So here's a off the subject question, but I talked to attorney Mark Gergis about this, and we were wondering about it too. 911 calls and police body cam footage. Sometimes it's out immediately. Sometimes it doesn't come out. We were specifically talking about the Paul Pelosi case. Where's the 911 call? Where's the body cam footage? Everyone sort of interested in what went on. There's a lot of speculation. How do they decide if that stuff comes out? And then how come some of it is out immediately and other stuff never appears to come out?
Well, different cities, different states have different policies. I couldn't tell you about California. 911 stuff calls are easy to release. Obviously, there might be confidentiality issues. You might want to protect somebody who's a potential witness. Body cam, you have a whole host of other issues. You know, to bring it back to, I said, look, there's discovery reform. That was part of the things that happened in New York in 2020. You have to deliver every scrap of information, no matter how irrelevant, to a case. And so a lot of cases just aren't going forward. We had a shooting in Times Square. A kid was shot, I think, in 2021. 79 police body cameras had to be downloaded, edited, anonymized for all the witnesses, and then delivered to the defense. So 79 different body cameras. That all of that footage had to be processed. So we're, you know, a lot of people are inundated us with FOIL requests for different, body camera footage. You have a scene where maybe 20 cops show up. All of that has to be reviewed before it's released. There is a huge volume of stuff we're dealing with. I'm sure that does not reflect on whatever's happening in San Francisco, which we're, you know, you probably did it. You have a huge response because it's a sensitive location. But the other stuff you hold out back because you're going to show it in court.
The people think the body cam stuff statistically is going to out the bad cops, but statistically it turns out that it slows down the role of the people that say the cop was a bad cop. So it's actually probably a good thing for cops. But I don't know, do most cops want to wear them?
No. They certainly at the beginning there was a lot of resistance, just, you know, for the same reasons that nobody wants to have a camera stuck in their face when they're just, you know, spending a regular day at work. They might complain about their wife, they might complain about their boss, and you're always afraid of what's going to get picked up with hot mic stuff. But then once you got used to it, you know, in the vast majority of the cops, having that footage vindicates the cop and shows the accuser, you know, is lying. So I think it's in time, cops are going to embrace them more and more. But it's tough. You know, you don't want to, you know, be under the hot lights the whole your 8 hours a day.
And it's not like they're performing on stage. They're two people sitting in a car together all day. That sucks to have all that recorded.
I'm reading down at the bottom of your bio, and I'm not sure if this is correct or not. At the bottom of the bio, it says, born in New York City, father was an FBI agent. That checks out. Mother was a psychologist. That checks out. And then it says, graduated from Harvard and was vice president of the Harvard Lampoon.
I was, yes. This is all true.
And then went on to walk the beat in the South Bronx?
Yep. So me and Harvey Schlossberg have a very strange resumes, but...
How'd you get from vice president of the Lampoon, and tell us what a douche Conan was, and to walking the streets of walking projects in the South Bronx?
Well, it's, you know, I stumbled into a job right after. I always wanted to write, but how do you make a living being a writer? I don't know. I figured I'd write books. I'd write this. I wound up. The first story I ever wrote was I got in an argument with a good buddy of mine from high school who was a transit cop. And this was around the time of the Rodney Kidd stuff in 91. He said, I bet you couldn't ride the he was in a plainclothes transit police. And he said, I bet you couldn't ride with me for 6 weeks without punching somebody in the face. You know, people are just horrible. You'll lose it. And I took him up and I didn't hit anybody in the face. And I decided to write about riding around the subways with a plane with a transit cop. That's the first magazine piece I ever got published. It went into something called the American Spectator. I wound up, you know, writing all these cop and crime stories, and I liked it. You know, I went and had a piece in the New Yorker on Potter's Field. But if they didn't take it and the American Spectator take it, I mean, there's one story. I wound up going to a literary magazine where I got three free copies of it, you know? So my friends who were cops were the happiest people I knew, at least at work. They're the ones, you know, your lawyer friends, they want to tell you stories about work. You don't care about what they have to say, but cops came home with great stories and they were really engaged by it. So I said, what the hell? I'll give it a try. You know, I really didn't expect it. I was 30 years old. I just turned 30 by the time I went into the academy, but it really worked for me.
Okay, Conan's 2 years older. We have to know what you know about him.
He is a friend, and he's one of the funniest human beings in the world.
Damn it!
It checks out.
The name of the podcast is called "Talk to Me." It's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Edward Conlon, thank you so much for joining us on my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
I can't wait to start this podcast. I'm going to start it later.
I just got to the bottom of this and running, you know, all this South Bronx business and FBI agent dad and graduated from Harvard, vice president of the Lampoon. I was like,
it's weird.
That must. Well, sometimes the bios get a little screwed up and there could be a piece of information from the next guest that got onto this one or something. But it checks out, as Edward would say.